The second hour passed like the first, except with one more person at the table. Gen Xuan proved to be a charming and intelligent fellow, with well-considered opinions on a number of the important topics of the day. He was a little older than the other professional benders at the table, having spent a few years on the Earth Rumble circuit before jumping to MLB, but he was still a young man, with a young man's eagerness to get a handle on the world. Once he got over the dual hurdles of his nervousness about the social awkwardness of showing up, and his nervousness at sharing a table with the Avatar and her friends, he proved to be excellent dinner company. Eventually, weary and happy in equal measures, the party paid their bill. Cora was slightly refreshed by the proprietor, whom Caitlin and the others appeared to know, not even offering to comp her, and adjourned to the street outside. "Oh, oh my. Camera, where is camera?" said Cora, waving a hand until Kate put her mini-camera in it. As was his wont when not dealing with an immediate call to action, Mogi had curled up against the nearest firm surface, in this case the front wall of the restaurant to the right of the door, and gone to sleep. Lacking any better ideas, the other animals taking part in the evening's excursion had all done the same, arranging themselves by design or serendipity by descending order of size, calling to mind those nesting dolls Cora had seen in a street market in the Siberian quarter of Bear City once. Thus, Neri had nestled herself within the curve of Mogi's furry bulk, then Sergei had rolled himself into a sort of tigery donut alongside her. Makoto was tucked into the protective arc of stripes this created, and within his snugly curled body snoozed Pabu the 17th, his fluffy ringed tail draped over the lemur's neck. The five creatures' collective snoring had a funky sort of syncopated quality, like somnolent jazz, all underpinned by Mogi's basso rumbles. "That is the most adorable thing I have ever seen," Karana mused quietly as Cora photographed the scene from several angles, using a low flash setting in hopes of not disturbing the animals. "One hates to wake them," Anthy agreed. "Unfortunately, we're going to have to, unless we want to swim back to the air temple," Kate pointed out. "I could probably fly us back," Nall said, "but that would be pretty showy offy, and it'd probably attract the Zeppelin cops." "Yes, let's not have that party tonight," Maki agreed. In the event, they waited 10 minutes, until at least one of the animals, it turned out to be Surge, woke before rousing the rest. Karana, Asana, and Gen parted from the rest of the group there with good nights and well wishes. "We'll be having a practice session at Shinobi Arena tomorrow afternoon," Asana told Anne. "You should come join us. You can meet Juan, he should be back from Gaoling by then, and you might learn a thing or two about defending yourself from other kinds of benders." She produced a small metal object from a pocket and handed it to the young samurai. "Show this to the guard at the back gate and he'll let you in. We'll be in practice hall too." Anne regarded the item she'd just been given. It was a metal token, like a coin, only a little larger and heavier, with the stylized cartoon Pabu head that was the Fire Ferret's jersey logo on the obverse, and the flame sigil of the Fire Nation on the reverse. Smiling, she pocketed it. "Sounds like fun," she said, then squared herself and bowed with the firebender salute. "Until then, Sifu Asana," she added with a smile. Asana returned the bow, the salute, and the smile, then went down to the corner to catch a streetcar uptown. Karana said she'd be in touch soon, collected Pabu, and headed off down one of the side streets, whistling, completely unconcerned with the lateness of the hour. Gen repeated his apologies to Corwin one last time for his colleague's behavior, then took himself off to find a subway station. The rest of them climbed aboard Mogi and headed back to Air Temple Island, where they scattered to bed. Only then did it occur to Cora, on the doorstep of the ladies' dorm, that she hadn't thought to make any better arrangement for Corwin's sleeping quarters during that day. But he told her he had a plan and sent her off to bed. "You have a plan?" Utrina inquired. Corwin smiled. "Well, I can't come inside with you two. It'd be disrespectful to the Air Temple. I don't think I should get too far away, though. Not under the circumstances." Anthy nodded, smiling, and Corwin smiled back and said, "So, show me which window is yours." This turned out to be handily situated around the back of the L-shaped annex, where most of the guest quarters were. Out of the way, but well situated, with a view of Republic City almost as good as that from the sentry post across the way. After seeing his sweethearts off to bed with kisses and declarations of love, he went back around until he stood outside the window, turned to face the city, took out his bison whistle, and blew it, knowing that only Mogi would respond to the particular ultrasonic note it played. The bison arrived only moments later, unsaddled and looking slightly puzzled, but once he'd landed and taken stock of the situation, he seemed to understand, nuzzling his master with a thoughtful look. "Well, Mogi, looks like it's just you and me," Corwin said. Mogi replied equably, "Rawr," and then settled himself down against the wall below Anthy and Utrina's window. Corwin lay down against his shaggy side, feet outstretched toward the city, and contemplated the skyline. A few minutes later, Cora's head and shoulders emerged from a window, two down from the one Corwin was camped under. She looked around, spotted Mogi, and called quietly, "Here, you might need this. Supposed to get chilly later tonight." "Thanks," Corwin replied as she lofted a blanket his way on a gust of wind. At the last moment, she put a little English on it so it unfurled and settled over him, prompting him to add fondly, "Show off." "You're one to talk," Cora replied. "Good night, Corwin." "Night," Corwin said, bundling the blanket around his shoulders. Cora gave him a parting wave and disappeared into her darkened window, though he noticed that, even on a cool night that she'd said was forecast to get cooler, she left it open. Corwin snuggled back against Mogi, remarking to himself that it would have been very convenient on several levels if he had known he had a sky bison a few years ago. That endless trek on foot across Sephira would have been a lot simpler. Then again, if he hadn't been on foot, he might not have met up with the rune knights when he had, and then the whole thing might have unfolded very differently. Or not at all. And that didn't even bear thinking about, did it? At a soft sound above and behind him, he looked up and back to see Utrina, from his current perspective upside down, leaning out over the windowsill. "All set out there?" she asked, her voice hushed. "I was going to offer you our spare blanket, but I see you've found one. And a bison," she added with a smile. "Yeah, the blanket just happened to come along," he replied. "Strange weather around here." "Well, I'll holler if anything comes up," she told him. "All quiet at the moment. Pleasant dreams. Love you." "You too," he said, and she went back inside, shutting the window behind her. A moment later, the light went out, and Corwin sat back in the dark and regarded Republic City again. He was physically tired, but not mentally. Too many things going on, too many things to think about. And not just inside the orbit of his own life, though his ancestors knew there was plenty happening there at the moment. He'd been mulling a number of things over for half an hour or so, not getting very far with any of them, when a flicker of white in the darkness made him look up. For a second, he thought it was one of the island's winged lemurs, on the way back on some late-night errand. But then it altered course, and he saw that it was Nall in his flying cat form, making for him. "Phew," Nall remarked as he landed on Corwin's head, furling his wings. "She's finally gone to sleep." Corwin rolled his eyes upward in a failed attempt to give his dragon friend a dubious look. "Dude, WTF," he said, pronouncing the letters individually. I know," said Nall, dropping down to Corwin's shoulder now that his wings were put away properly. "I guess it's been pretty obvious." "No more so than a moderately sized house fire," Corwin said dryly. "And I know what you're going to ask," Nall went on. "And?" The dragon sighed. "And we're sort of on a break right now." "I see," Corwin said, letting the demand for elaboration go unvoiced. "Last Thursday night, after I left with Hikaru and Fu, stuff happened," Nall replied. "Things were said." "Oh," said Corwin, and then, "You seemed okay on Friday." "Well, we're not enemies. I mean, it's not like Blossom and What's-His-Face," Nall argued. "We're just stepping back for a while. Space is required." "And Lakpa is..." Nall hesitated. "Available?" Corwin suggested. "I was going to say inescapable," Nall replied. "Or possibly relentless." He headbutted the side of Corwin's head grumpily. "Also, that was cheap." Corwin sighed. "Yeah, you're right, sorry. Still, I mean..." He shrugged. "Even if you and Umi are on a break, somehow I doubt Jinora would be amused. I mean, here I am outside, so as not to disrespect the temple by being in there after sundown with, let me just emphasize this, my wife, and you come toddling back from..." "Hey, whoa, no, come on," interrupted Nall hastily. "Cat mode only after dark. I have standards. We've just been talking." She was making it pretty plain at dinner that she was interested in a fairly vigorous conversation, said Corwin archly. "I know, right?" Nall agreed. "You'd think air nomad girls would be into moderation and temperance, but apparently Lakpa skipped that class." "Does she know we're most likely leaving this weekend?" Corwin asked. "She wants to come with us." Corwin thought about that for a second, then said, yeah, don't see Jinora going for that, either." I know," Nall repeated. "I'm working on it. I don't want to just slam the door in her face, you know? I mean, she's gone in an unexpected new direction on me, but we've been friends for years. I don't want to hurt her. Besides, what she's feeling... well... I don't think it's that one-sided, you know?" "Yeah," said Corwin after a moment's hesitation. Tilting his head back, he looked up at the darkened window. "I know." Wednesday, March 17th, 2410. Over the last few days, Cora had slipped out of her usual habit of checking the sports page in the Morning Tribune first, in favor of proceeding directly to Section 4 and seeing what Emily Wong had to say about the city's mystery visitors. Today, however, she was back to her usual pattern. As expected, the sports page featured a prominent article about the previous afternoon's Fire Ferrets exhibition match. This would probably have happened anyway, since the Fire Ferrets were the hometown team, but the tone was a bit different than it normally would have been. There was much made of the Ferrets' dramatic come-from-behind victory, and of the curiously slow start made by the team's heretofore unknown substitute Earthbender, but the Tribune's sports writers were a sober lot, who confined themselves to covering the events rather than speculating about the personalities. The closest they got to that kind of thing was a brief and well-researched sidebar on the history and controversial present of Rule 74. Over in Section 4, however, Emily's editors were clearly less inclined toward restraint. They had once again unpacked their outbreak of war headline scales, blaring from the top of the first page, "The same man! Mysterious Earthbender is the Phoenix House Stranger. Are the Fire Ferrets part of the new team avatar? Rest of team takes in the game." An apologetic caption noted that the photographs here, unlike those of these subjects in previous editions, were not taken by our correspondent Emily Wong, as she was not assigned to the sports beat, and was therefore not cleared to take press photos within the precincts of Shiro Shinobi Arena. Cora thought that showed in the fact that they weren't as good, particularly those of the rest of the gang in the stands. Something about the framing just wasn't quite on. She supposed the Trib's sports photogs were probably not as adept at getting pics of people in the bleachers as they were of photographing the game itself, and she had to admit the action shots of the players were pretty good. Cora especially liked the one of Zanya just on her way out of the ring, surrounded by dust and water and fire, her face curiously serene and resigned behind her face guard. As she was reading the rest of the perplexed, but now more convinced than ever that something big was in the offing, article to the table, Cora's gear phone pinged. Not an incoming call, but a text message. Still reading, she got the phone out with her free hand and flipped it open, glancing at it between paragraphs to read the newly arrived message. Chong, why are you doing this to me? Snorting, Cora thumbed back, sorry, unintentional, we'll call soon, then folded the phone back up and put it away. That was Chong, she said to Utina's curious look. He's getting a little desperate. I can only assume that Emily Wong is at this point camping in his in-tray. Utina laughed. Well, I suppose we'd better let the poor girl off the hook soon. And get Chong a nice fruit basket or something, Corbin added ruefully. That does raise the awkward point that you don't actually have a plan for her payoff yet, Anthea observed. Sure I do, said Corwin. Or, well, an idea, anyway. Cora, what's this thing you keep telling Chong I'm not helping you with? Huh? Oh, the Comet case? Asked Cora. One of my contacts in the RCPD's detective division got word that the Red Monsoon Triad is moving a big shipment of one of the latest stupidly dangerous street drugs of choice through a front of theirs in town, sometime within the next few days. When you haven't seen me around, I've mainly been out helping him try to pin down exactly when that's going to be, or planning the raid. Uh-huh, said Corwin, smiling. I thought it might be something like that. That sounds like something an intrepid reporter could work with, Utina said, catching the line of his thoughts. She works the society page, Nall objected. Yeah, but it's obvious from her copy that she doesn't want to, Utina replied. Besides, you haven't met her. She's pretty fierce. She grinned. If we hadn't cut in when we did, I'm pretty sure she'd have decked Mr. No-Neck at the Velvet Pal, or at least tried to. Said Cora thoughtfully. Well, it's not unknown for us to take people from the press along on operations like that, if it's something we think is in the public interest to know about, and if we're reasonably sure they won't get somebody killed. Some reporters are a real liability in a tight spot, others not so much. I'd have to meet her to know whether I'd be willing to propose embedding her in the op to Eitaro. It's his collar, I'm just fire support. Well, why don't we do that then, tomorrow or the next day, Utena suggested. I think we're all going to be too busy today. The day was indeed a rather full one. March 17th happened to be a special day on several of the group's calendars. It was Caitlin's birthday, and Utena and Anthea's wedding anniversary. Also the anniversary of Corwin's investiture as one of the Aesir, and the official date of Nall's recognition as Draconia's Paragon of White Dragons, though the ceremony itself took place later. In some years, they all went and celebrated these things collectively. This year, they had a group lunch, then dispersed to mark their occasions in their own more or less private ways, and those who didn't have a particular special occasion to mark were at their leisure. Amy and Rory went into town to tourist it up a bit, like Corwin and Utena had on their first day in the city, except without the antique car. They got about the same number of stares, though, even without it. Rory was surprised to find that almost as many of them were directed at him as at her. He was accustomed to Amy drawing attention. She was a 6-foot-tall Scottish redhead with a sword and a tartan miniskirt. If he had been the sort of bloke who found it difficult to accept other people appreciating his girlfriend on an aesthetic level, he'd have been institutionalized, or worse, dumped, a long, long time ago. It was a less familiar experience to be stared at himself. Rory Williams was not, by his own internal standards, as by those of places where he most often found himself, a particularly arresting character. About the same height, sandy-haired and almost perpetually in need of a shave, he counted as his only really distinctive feature a fairly large nose, and that wasn't so large that people would tend to stop and stare at it in the street. When he and Amy were out in public together, a lot of people didn't even notice him, which generally suited him just fine. Today, though, he cut as plainly foreign a figure as Amy by the standards of the locals, and that made him an object, not of occasional amazement like her, but of undeniable curiosity. Amy noticed it too, and it seemed to amuse her. She'd catch his eye and give him a sly little smile occasionally as they roamed the city, taking in this and that and nothing in particular. They passed the first half of the afternoon wandering the Station Square Market, then headed over to the Republic City Art Museum. There, Amy sought out the local equivalent of the post-impressionist period, her particular favorite period of Earth's art history, while Rory spent an inordinate amount of time examining the most unwieldy single item in the museum's collection, the colossal battle scene fresco, The Day of Black Sun. This, depicting the Earth Kingdom and Water Tribe's abortive invasion of the Fire Nation in 100 ASC, covered an entire wall at the back of the Art of the Hundred-Year War Gallery. It was so vast that Rory, armed with a giant gatefold diagram giving the name or probable name of each figure whose identity was known or suspected, was only about halfway across when Amy reached him again, having made a complete circuit of the museum's south wing. As such, he was slightly nonplussed when, within 30 seconds of arriving back at his side, Amy pointed at the painting and said, "Oh, hey, it's us." Rory partly folded up the key and looked up. "Where?" he asked. Amy pointed again, leaning a little closer. "Right there. About 3/4 of the way up." Rory peered at the fresco, then nodded. "So it is," he said, "although I don't recall us being in that particular spot, or being quite so Conan and Red Sonja." Amy grinned. "Artistic license." "I should say so," Rory agreed. Anne Cross returned to Shiro Shinobi Arena after lunch, not to take in another match, there were none scheduled, but to watch the fire ferrets at practice. She had no trouble gaining access to the backstage training areas thanks to the token Azana had given her the night before. There, she was introduced to Xiang Wan, a big, cheerful, slightly sheepish man who asked her to pass on his thanks to Corwin for filling in for him, and then the team went back to work. Anne had only been expecting to watch the fire ferrets practice, but none of them would hear of it, and before long she was right in the thick of it. The way Azana approached firebending here was different from the way she did it at the academy. The fundamentals were the same, but the MLB flavor was a little more fluid, a little more improvisational. And, as she had noticed during the match itself, it was, despite being part and parcel of a combat sport, more restrained in many ways than traditional firebending. When Anne put this to her during a water break, Azana nodded and said, "Yes, you're right. You see, a lot of the bending we do in the ring evolved from street fighting techniques in the early days of the Republic City." Xiang Wan nodded. "A lot of today's pro benders don't like to talk about it, but the roots of our sport lie largely in crime," he said. "People started making side bets on battles between the bending triads, and eventually someone realized, hey, wait a minute, this could go mainstream." "That, and there were earlier forms of bending dueling. Firebenders have the Agni Kai, for instance, and the Earth Rumbles have been around a lot longer than pro bending," said Karana. "Either way, the sport eventually went legit, but it took a long time. In Grand Grand's day, it was still pretty shady." "And so even today, a lot of the techniques involved can trace their roots back to those early street fighters," Azana concluded. "In the case of firebending, one of the things they discovered was that the traditional methods tended to destroy a lot of property. Most of them were originally military techniques, and in that context, collateral damage wasn't really very important. But in a street battle, it's a constant concern. You wouldn't automatically think of triads as that concerned with that sort of thing, but from their perspective, it does no good to take over a block if you burn it down in the process." "And that was nothing compared to what earthbending or waterbending could do to property values," Xiang agreed. Karana grinned. "Ask Grangren sometime if you want that story." Nall stood at the rail on the Harmony Towers observation deck, gazing thoughtfully out at the northern expanse of Republic City and the craggy mountains beyond. They reminded him of home, inasmuch as Draconia even was home. He never lived there, and yet he still felt an instinctive connection to the place and its landscape, such that this view could touch him with nostalgia for a land he'd rarely even visited. By draconic standards, his life path had been a strange one from the very first day, and though he wouldn't have traded his life to date for many things, it troubled him a little that Matalde's youngling was predestined for the same weird boat. He didn't mind, and he supposed the young Red wouldn't either. But still, Nall found himself with certain reservations about the idea that the practice looked like becoming a habit, with Draconia's nobility and Corwin's family line. Lakpa returned from buying a couple of sweet bean rolls from the observation deck food vendor, saw him frowning pensively off into the distance, and paused to regard him for a few moments. On some level, she was still getting used to the idea that this shockingly handsome young man really was the same being as her childhood friend and foil, though on another level, she understood it without question. Something in the vaguely feline angles of his face, she supposed, or his deep red eyes, which were the same, just larger. He had the same shock of brown hair in front, too, that his flying cat form had as a sort of crest on top of his head. Satisfied, she closed the remaining distance between them and startled him slightly by hugging his arm. "You look like Great Grand Grand Genora with that face on," she chided him. "What's the matter?" "Nothing," he said unconvincingly. "I'm fine. What you got there? Bean rolls?"
"It's not nothing. Nothing wouldn't make you look like that," Lakpa insisted.
"Come on, you can tell me." She squeezed his arm and laid her head on his shoulder.
"You can tell me anything."
"Anything?" Nall wondered skeptically.
"Anything," replied Lakpa positively.
Nall seemed to be considering that for a few seconds. Then, without any build-up to it at all, he said, "I killed my cousin Nax the other day." Without releasing his arm, Lakpa leaned away from him a little, not in a nervous bid for some space, but so she could look at his face and try to tell whether he was messing around with her. That would have been the usual thing. But his face was perfectly serious, even a little solemn. He wasn't looking back at her, but out at the city, as he went on. "It was a duel, you understand. I didn't just up and murder a relative for no reason. We have codes about that kind of thing, you see? I gave him an out, and he didn't take it. So I had to kill him." Lakpa gazed thoughtfully at him for a few seconds. With a gentle but insistent pressure on his arm, she guided him to a bench a few yards away and sat him down on it. Then, slightly to his surprise, she nestled next to him, still holding onto his arm, and put her head back on his shoulder.
"Tell me how it happened," she said, her voice low.
"It was a duel," Nall repeated. "I mean, I didn't like Nax. He was a genuine monster and a war criminal, and I'm glad he's dead. But I didn't set out to be the one who made him that way. He pushed and pushed, and finally hit that point where there was no other choice. I had to fully embrace my entire draconic nature in ways I never have before. And part of me really hates that he made me do that, particularly in front of witnesses." He paused, collecting his thoughts, and then added quietly, "particularly in front of Umi."
"Who's Umi?" Lakpa wondered.
"Was my girlfriend," said Nall. "We'd sort of just broken up when Nax showed up, but she was still there, and Nax didn't know that part, so..." He shrugged. "Draconic culture has issues with that kind of thing." Lakpa didn't reply, other than by remaining where she was, a warm and supportive presence. On some level, Nall was surprised by how well she seemed to be taking this. He'd grown accustomed to thinking of her as, well, as a bit of a lightweight, really. Cheerful, carefree, a little bit flighty. Good company, she'd always been that, except when carried away with potentially painful little girl affection, but not particularly deep. Now, though, she let go of his arm to slip the nearer of hers around him, holding him a little closer, and said softly, "That must have been terrible." Nall drew a deep breath through his nose, then let it out slowly through his mouth, shivering a little. "It was a bit," he agreed. Then, with a weak attempt at his usual wry humor, he went on, "I should probably have warned you sooner that you were cozying up to a dangerous beast with deep-rooted cultural maiden issues that only sort of looks like a rakishly handsome lad. Sorry about that." He paused, then went on in a less flippant, more resigned tone. "If you want to forget about the last couple days, that's..."
Nal, Lakpa interrupted quietly. Said Nal, turning to look at her.
Stop talking, said Lakpa, and then she enforced it by kissing him soundly.
Nal looked momentarily surprised, then faintly dismayed. He'd been expecting those unintended revelations, made so suddenly and bluntly thanks to their lingering rawness within him, would cause her to back up a little. He hadn't really wanted to do it that way, but he had been hoping that he'd find some way of getting her to back up a little, at some point during this excursion. Instead, the hell with it, he thought, and kissed her back.
Utna wasn't actually expecting the action to involve her when she and Anthy arrived at Ming and Daughter's clothiers on the dot of 5:15. Under Cora's light overcoat, borrowed for purposes of being at least slightly less obvious downtown, Utna was already dressed in the clothes she'd been fitted with the last time she'd come here. That was, after all, just the past Saturday, and she was on her way to the very same destination, so she, silly girl, had assumed that the daughters would ignore her, except perhaps to fix her hair, while they concentrated on Anthy. Instead, the same thing happened that had happened Saturday. Upon entry, they were politely greeted by the full staff of the shop, and then each was whisked off to a different corner by a brace of daughters and given a complete workup. Utina's fancy clothes from the weekend were briskly removed and taken away, and then new ones in an almost entirely different style were fitted in their place. She didn't see Anthy again until nearly half an hour later, when, just as before, they found themselves gently but firmly ejected onto the sidewalk, with polite farewells and assurances that the things they'd come in with would be cleaned and sent back to the Air Temple. As she and Corwin had done Saturday afternoon, Utna and Anthy stood there for a moment, blinking at the suddenness of it all, then turned to take each other in. Having evidently read the present situation differently, the daughters had, without asking her a single question, entirely changed up their game regarding Utna from the last time they'd seen her. Before, when she'd arrived as Corwin's date in the midst of their honeymoon, they'd dressed her as a sort of paragon of glamorous femininity, a state in which she was entirely unaccustomed to finding herself, and between their consummate skill and the specialness of the occasion, they'd made it work. This time, on the other hand, they'd gone the other way, adapting a style of menswear similar to what they'd pulled out for Corwin to her very different frame, on the fly and without comment. The result didn't make her seem mannish, but, like the best of her regular clothes, rather as if men dressed the way they did in homage to her. The Fire Nation cues remained. The wasp-waisted, heavily brocaded jacket she wore had the same sort of fitted shoulders as the little red demi-cape they'd draped her with on Saturday, and the same reds and deep black dominated the color scheme. They'd even put her in a pair of those genie-toed shoes, which she'd expected to be both less comfortable and more absurd-looking than they really were. Not having been shown a mirror at any point, Utna didn't really know how the whole outfit worked, but Anthy wasn't laughing, which she took to be a good sign. For her part, Anthy looked, there was no other word for it to Utna, radiant. Taking cues from who knew what, the daughters had discerned her interest in air nomad culture and dressed her in a dress-under-sleeveless-robe combination very like those worn by the Air Temple elders, complete with a luxuriously long and broad sash that took a supportive turn around her middle and then up over her left shoulder, an arrangement which looked both practical and comfortable. The color palette they'd used for her, though, was slightly different. The sash was the standard bright scarlet that airbender women wore, the robe a slightly deeper crimson which harkened back to the dress Anthy had worn first as the Rose Bride, and then, on some occasions, in her capacity as High Priestess of the Pillar. The full-sleeved, ankle-length dress beneath, though,
was not the usual air nomad yellow, but instead a lush, shimmery gray that seemed to sparkle slightly in the sun. It was, Utrinna realized, the same material Corwin's waistcoat had been made of in his Ming outfit from Saturday. Beyond that, they'd done something to exaggerate slightly the wave in her hair, so that it became a full-on Rita Hayworth tumble of long, loose curls, utterly casual and yet somehow studied, their rich violet color setting off the quartz-flecked gray of her dress. Utrinna had never really bought into the old saw that pregnant women glowed, but Anthy seemed to just then. Though that might have been the afternoon sunlight, as they were getting on toward the golden hour when the light took on that certain quality, much prized by photographers. As Utrinna had the thought, they were photographed, just as she and Corwin had been. Utrinna turned to see Emily Wong standing about where the Coromobile had been, across the street, giving them a startled look over the viewfinder of her Rolleiflex. When Utrinna looked toward her, they made momentary eye contact in which the reporter gave her a plaintive what-is-going-on look, but Utrinna just smiled and shooed her away, mouthing, "Later." "That's your friend the reporter, I assume," said Anthy with a smile as Emily beat it to the corner and caught a streetcar. "Yep," Utrinna replied. "Probably hopelessly confused now. That's the second time this week she's seen me coming out of this shop with a date who's dressed to kill." "You're not bad yourself, my love," said Anthy, taking her arm. "Shall we?" "You're sure you don't want me to get us a cab?" Utrinna wondered. "It's a fair walk to Kwong's from here." Anthy smiled. "It's a lovely day, and we've plenty of time," she said. "I'd rather savor the moment." Utrinna glanced at her, then grinned and patted her hand. "As you like it," she said. After bending practice, having no wish to do any further training that day, nor to deal with Deng, Azana and Juniper adjourned to the former's apartment to talk over the day's work and consider next steps. Actually, they'd started that during practice, and didn't stop during the walk from Shinobi Arena to the building where Azana lived. But these are details. Azana lived on the top floor of a studio apartments building catering mainly to students and artists, conveniently located about halfway between the Fire Lord Zuko Firebending Academy and the arena. It reminded Anne a bit of the worldwide building in New Avalon, where Corwin lived. It even had the same sort of old-timey cage elevator, though Azana skipped it and just took the stairs. Her apartment was a bit like Corwin's, too, just one big room apart from the partitioned-off bathroom space in one corner, with a similar lack of any fancy ceiling to cover up the iron rafters and industrial ductwork lining what was, on this floor, the underside of the roof. It was neater than Corwin's place, not because Corwin was any kind of slob, but because Azana was apparently about as tidy as a person could be without being actually pathological about it. She had different taste in decorations, too. Where Corwin was fond of repurposed municipal signage and old posters, Azana went for abstract Fire Nation artworks and landscape paintings. On one wall, near the couch Anne chose when invited to take a seat, was a small group of framed portraits. One was the official depiction of the current Fire Lord, denoted by a small brass plaque affixed to the bottom edge of the frame. Anne recognized another as the same picture of the late Fire Lord Zuko that they had at his eponymous academy. The others were presumably family members. After a moment's thought, she recognized one of them as Ito-sensei as a much younger man, dressed in what looked like a military uniform. Azana went to the kitchen area, which was separated from the rest of the apartment only by an island counter, and bustled about for a few moments gathering up supplies for tea. "One moment and I'll get the hibachi started," she said, nodding toward a bronze brazier standing under a vent hood at the end of the room. You can't make proper tea on a gas hob. I don't care what Karana says, she added wryly. Anne considered for a second, then rose and said, Oh, actually, let me. There's something I want to show you. Azana paused, giving her a curious look. Oh? Anne nodded, then focused her attention on the hibachi. This required concentration. She wanted to ignite the charcoal she could see piled in the brazier, after all, not explode half the room. In the old days, that would have been a dicey proposition. Nowadays, less so, and even after the handful of days she'd spent training in firebending, she could feel still more of a difference. Narrowed eyes, a slight push, a distinct and not unpleasant, that was a marked change from the bad old days, sensation, and the brazier suddenly thumped to life, the flame rising merrily up and then settling down to a steady burn as white ash spread across the surface of the charcoal. The job done, she glanced nervously at her hostess to see the reaction. It hadn't escaped her that this might be a mistake. She might have misjudged, or even imagined, the bond she felt developing between her and her new teacher. It could be too soon, or too sudden and dramatic a demonstration. Doubt rose up a trifle belatedly within her as she saw Azana gazing wide-eyed at the burning hibachi, her expression too blank to read. You set that on fire just by looking at it, Azana said slowly. Well, it's a little more complicated than that, but basically, yeah, Anne admitted. She cringed a little inside and waited to see whether the moment was about to go terribly wrong. Azana stood looking at the brazier for a moment longer, then turned to Anne and unveiled the biggest smile the young samurai had yet seen on her face. That is amazing, said Azana positively. I can't do that. Even grandfather can't do that. I've never heard of any firebender who could. The closest thing I've ever heard to that ability was a man back in Avatar Aang's day who could firebend without moving his hands. But if the legends about him are true, he would have destroyed the building trying to do what you just did. Anne felt her knees go slightly weak with relief and covered it by pretending she'd intended to sit back down on the couch anyway, saying, Yeah, well, there was a time when I probably would have too. Azana went and put the kettle on, then returned and sat down in an armchair opposite the sofa. Have you always been able to do that? Not always, always, Anne replied, shaking her head. I didn't have any special abilities at all until I was about 12. Most people like me back home don't. It's kind of a puberty thing. Oh. Azana sat back, crossing her legs elegantly at the knee, and considered. That must have been tough. Around here, most benders are benders from the time we can walk, which can make life tough for our parents, she added wryly, but it does mean that by the time we're that age, we have a pretty good handle on the basics. She tilted her head thoughtfully. But when it did manifest itself, that's the form it took? Anne nodded. Firebending the way you do it is a new thing for me. Korra showed me how to do that basic punch last week. That was the first time I'd ever actually, you know, moved fire around instead of just making it happen somewhere. She gave her crooked little smile and added, I kind of like it better. Easier to see what's going on. Still, the other way does have its uses. I should say. Azana smiled. Korra said you had potential. She didn't mention that you were an out-and-out prodigy. Anne blushed slightly. Believe me, you wouldn't be saying that if you'd been around for some of my early attempts. Azana heard the water come to a boil and got up, still smiling. We all have to start somewhere, she said, and then went to take the kettle off the coals and make the tea. A few minutes later, as they sipped their tea and talked firebending techniques, the two were interrupted by the high, silvery sound of a bell, which Anne realized was coming from an elegant, old-fashioned telephone which stood on the end table next to Azana's chair. Giving the instrument the classic who-could-that-be look, Azana excused herself and picked it up. "Hello?" she said, and then instantly frowned at the reply. "No, Mother, this is really not a good time. No." "No," she repeated with greater emphasis. "I'm with a student. Yes, I have a student now." Eye roll. "Yes, that's right. Grandfather finally talked me into it." "What?" "Really, Mother, I've told you..." She paused then, her face taking on a thoughtful, slightly mischievous look as she glanced speculatively at Anne. Then, with a mildly evil smile, she said as if conceding a point, "Well, yes, I suppose she is rather handsome, but I hardly..." "What?" Another frown. "You asked. It's hardly my fault you jumped to..." "If you're going to take that tone with me, Mother, this conversation is over. You know the rules." After that little contretemps, Azana's mother was speaking loudly enough that Anne could actually hear her, a tiny, tinny voice coming from a handset now held a wincing inch or two away from Azana's ear. "You can't blame me if I worry about you, darling. I don't want you to turn out like your Aunt Zina." Now outright scowling, Azana snapped, "Which Aunt Zina? The one who's been blissfully happy with the same life partner for the last 15 years? That Aunt Zina? Yes, gracious me, Mother, I wouldn't want to end up like her." "You know I don't approve of..." Azana's mother began, but Azana interrupted her. "Yes, Mother, I know. And you know that I refuse to have this conversation with you again. Aunt Zina's life choices are hers, and mine are mine. And if you can't respect either one, then I'll thank you to refrain from raising the topic." She got hold of herself with a visible effort, composed herself in her chair, and then said calmly, "Now, is there anything you would actually care to talk about?" Anne didn't hear Azana's mother's reply this time. She had subsided enough that it only came across as a sort of wordless, petulant buzz, and after a few seconds of it, Azana said in a cordial but cool tone of voice, "Fine. In that case, I'll get back to what I was doing. Have a good day, Mother." The other end disconnected with a clearly audible click. Azana sat looking at the handset for a moment, then sighed, hung up the phone, and said apologetically, "I'm sorry you had to hear that. She usually doesn't call until evening." "Does that happen a lot?" Anne wondered. "Almost every time she calls," Azana confirmed. "She's convinced I'm getting up to all sorts of wild hijinks, living alone in the terrible city, all of them disreputable and none likely to present her with grandchildren." Rolling her eyes, she added, "At least not legitimate ones." She sat back in her chair and heaved a sigh. "I don't want you to get the wrong idea," she added wearily. "I do love my mother, but by all the spirits she tasks me." Said Anne sympathetically. Then, after casting about momentarily for anything she could say to break up the moment, she held up her cup and said, "This is really good tea." Azana met her eyes, giving her a skeptical, "I see what you did there" look, and then laughed, the moment successfully broken. She raised her cup in response and said, "Your health, Junie-chan. And my mother's, too, spirits help me," she added wryly. At Kuang's family cuisine, as at Ming and daughter's clothiers, No one gave any indication that they had ever seen Utina before. As he showed them to their seats, at a different table from the one she and Corwin had been at a few days ago, the head waiter even addressed her as Sir, and stood correctly aside while she pulled out Anthy's chair for her, which seemed to amuse Anthy inordinately. In fact, as they ate and talked of various matters, it began to dawn on Utina that many things seemed to be amusing Anthy at least a little inordinately tonight. She was in quite a merry frame of mind, and in very good form as a raconteuse. At one point she told a hysterically funny story about one of the trips she and Corwin had taken down the coast road in Sephiro of a Saturday, during the time shortly after his trial that he'd spent living there, seeing them only on the weekends. "Oh, be careful," Utina warned her when their entrees arrived. "Those red things are really..." She blinked as Anthy picked up one of those red things with her chopsticks and ate it, seeming to go out of her way to crunch it between her teeth. "Hot," Utina finished, a little lamely. "Yes, they are," Anthy remarked, and then, seeming quite satisfied with that realization, proceeded to go hunting for another one. "What?" she asked, seeing Utina's startled look. "Nothing," Utina replied, returning her attention to her own dinner. Then she smiled slyly and added, "But you're not kissing me with that mouth until that stuff wears off."